For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, are we ready to get down into some Mark tonight, chapter 10? We're going to be reading a passage where Jesus gets into the whole subject of sexuality and marriage. Take a little time on this. It's a pretty big area to think through together. Let's read. Verse 1, we read, Jesus left Capernaum and went down to the region of Judea in the area east of the Jordan River. Once again, crowds gathered around him, and as usual, he was teaching. Some Pharisees came and tried to trap him with this question. Should a man be allowed to divorce his wife? We have rabbinic literature from this period, actually, this whole debate about divorce that was going on among the rabbis. And they probably wanted to catch him taking a position with the one side that forbade divorce under any circumstances and then bust him out to show that the Old Testament did allow it. Anyway, Jesus answered them with a question. What did Moses say in the law about divorce? Well, he permitted it, they replied. He said a man can give his wife a written notice of divorce and send her away. And Jesus said, yeah, he wrote this commandment only as a concession to your hard hearts. But God made them male and female from the beginning of creation. This explains why a man leaves his father and mother and is joined to his wife. And the two are united into one. Since they're no longer two, but one, let no one split apart what God has joined together. The famous words from the wedding ceremony, what God has joined together, let not man separate. You notice Jesus' discourse on this goes back beyond Moses, all the way to Genesis. Male and female, he created them. That's Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and it says he created humans in his own image. Male and female. And he also quotes from Genesis 2 here, for this reason a man leaves his father and mother and cleaves to his wife, and the two become one flesh. So, yeah, the two are united into one. That turns out to be God's explanation for what's really supposed to be happening in a sexual relationship. It's pretty significant phrase, and it comes up repeatedly in the Bible. For instance, in 1 Corinthians, the Apostle Paul, also discussing human sexuality, says, don't you know that if a man joins himself to a prostitute, he becomes one body with her? For the scriptures say the two are united into one, quotes that same verse from Genesis 2. But the person who is joined to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. Run away from sexual sin. No other sin so clearly affects the body as this one does. For sexual immorality is a sin against your own body. Or don't you know that your body really is the temple of the Holy Spirit who lives in you and was given to you by God? You do not belong to yourself, for God bought you with a high price, so you must honor God with your body. Both of these, then, are really reflecting the Christian ethics of sexuality, which is that God designed people a certain way, and he designed us as sexual beings, and he intended for that to be expressed in the context of a union relationship where two people become one in a marriage, in a family. Not the 20 people become one, not the 40 people become one, but the two become one. Sexual monogamy. That is the biblical teaching. And I think that as Christians, I notice some Christians are a little bit feel on the defensive in this whole area, because our culture has veered so far away from what God teaches us in his word that just by sheer weight of numbers and social pressure, you can feel pretty awkward sometimes holding forth, you know, God's picture for sexuality. So I want to spend a little bit of time here tonight thinking through the ethics of sexuality and whether this is a moral category, whether it belongs in a moral category or not. And then we'll take take yet another week next week to focus in on how to have a good marriage. This term, sexual immorality, in Greek is the word porneia, that we get porno from. It's a pretty broad term covering numerous different sexual activities that are immoral. It doesn't have to be coitus. We're not into Clinton's definition of what constitutes sex here. It's the whole range of things that are wrongdoing in the sexual area. And the Bible's position is that porneia is not love. That's the problem with it. We're taught as followers of God to practice love with each other. Jesus said this is the most important thing. Learning to love God, learning how to love others the way you love yourself. That's what Christian living's about, and porneia doesn't fit into that scenario at all. And yet, I think porneia would be a good, the porneia perspective, if we can say that, would be a good term by which we can describe 21st century American ethics on sexuality. They're all about the porneia. In the porneia perspective, sex and morality are really two different things. You know, postmodern people believe that there is such a thing as morality, most of them, at least in theory, that you probably should develop some kind of moral set. But sex doesn't fit into that. Instead, what we're confronted with is sexual preference. About the only rule you can go by is if you prefer it, then it's right for you. If you don't prefer it, then that's wrong for you. And so sex has really been moved out of the realm of moral thinking, with one or two lonely exceptions. You know, for some reason, pedophilia is still considered wrong by most people. It's hard to see how even that's going to last, though, because the basis for why do we assume that something is morally wrong, or can something really be objectively morally wrong if there is no objective moral standard that stands over everyone, like God? What's the basis? I think we can anticipate erosion even on that front. If you do have sexual morals, I guess that's considered okay, but it's your personal opinion, so those morals are not objective or external to you. Those are just your moral opinions that you set up, but they apply only to you, and it's fine as long as you remember to never suggest that anyone else should have to comply with that moral standard. Even if people do things that are a little shady, you know, like a lot of people would feel like, well, prostitution isn't that good. On the other hand, it's a victimless crime, so, you know, it's not like we should really get worked up about it. And as far as Christians go, very strong view that the Christian view of sex, way too low. That Christians think sex is dirty, and so they're way too restrictive. They just, they have some problems. They're not liberated. They're inhibited. And living in an ancient mindset that's completely out of step. And so they're still trying to suppress their sexuality. That's kind of the porneia perspective that we're up against today. The servant love perspective, completely different. What we're taught is when it comes to sex and morality, that in fact sex is highly moral, based on God's design of human beings. Exactly what Jesus and Paul were both arguing in these passages. That God has made us a certain way, and we're free to violate that and contradict it if we want to, but every time we do, there's actually an internal tearing of the sensitive spiritual fabric of our soul. And people may not always realize this is happening, but that damage is being done to you and to the one that you're engaging in porneia with. And for that reason, it is harmful and it is morally wrong. Highly moral. It's never victimless. Because this damage is being done. Damage to the mind. Damage to our perspective. Damage to our future ability to build deep relationships. It's all happening. We would argue that the pornea view is the one with the low view of sex. We think that the pornea view is practically on an animalistic level. You know, we look out here and if we see a couple of dogs getting it on, you've seen that before. You know, they'll look over at you like, what are you looking at? You know, next night it might be another dog, you know, it's like, so what? And none of us would feel upset or morally outraged about that, because after all, they are dogs, and that's the way dog life works. I mean, they're just animals, you know. The question is, are we like that also? In the pornea view, yes, we are, essentially. They're essentially saying, you know, sex is just a physical urge that needs to be relieved. And, you know, don't worry about it. If it feels good, do it. And whatever goes. That is a low view of sex. Way lower than what God prescribes for us. We would argue that this pornea view is not elevating sex to some new level of freedom and liberation at all, but in fact is bringing sex down to the level of the tawdry, the commonplace, and the pointless. This denial of who we are, as made by our Creator, designed by Him, fails at each and every point, and the signs of that are all around us. People who live and engage in sexual immorality suffer pangs of misery. This has been not only detailed for us in the Bible, but also in modern sociological research. There's the sickness that often accompanies this. I think that's, you know, bad, but it's kind of the least of our worries. One of the worst things is the inability to form successful families later on. When we engage in sexual immorality, we are compromising our ability to succeed in marriage. And our culture is a blazing, blinking sign advertising that fact. Exactly coincident with the rise of the acceptance of pornea in our culture has been the decline of quality marriage. We lead the world in divorce rates. Married people, even many who don't divorce, report that they're profoundly unhappy. Adultery is extremely commonplace, with the majority of married men in our country admitting to adulterous affairs. Yeah, that's pretty damaging. That's damaging to everyone concerned, the children. The literature is vast and it's unanimous on this point, that divorce has a super negative impact on the children involved. Children of divorce is a whole branch of sociological research, and there's no dissenting voice saying, well, it is helpful in this way. It's just bad, bad, bad. Lower academic performance, greater incidence of poverty, higher incidence of juvenile delinquency. These longitudinal studies have now been running, some of them, for 30 years. They followed these kids into adulthood and have found that the effects are lingering, that there's a measurable, significant difference where children of divorce suffer more often from adult depression, are more likely to commit suicide, earn on average 10 to 15% less than children of intact families. Things like that, that can be measured. What all there is on the inside, well, there's a lot that can't be measured there. And I know many of us here are children of divorce. We don't need anyone to tell us how damaging divorce can be in a child's life. The inability, ultimately, if we live according to this modern, you know, pornea standard, we actually lose the ability to really love another sexually. The whole proposition of sexual immorality. You know, if you're sleeping with someone or living with someone and you're not married to them, why? Think about it. What's the reason? Why is it that you're having sex but you don't want to get married? Isn't it because you're enjoying being able to gratify yourself using the other person's body, but you want to retain the freedom to possibly reject that person if things go a certain way? Isn't that the reason why you're not willing to get married? People, you hardly ever put it in those terms. It's usually better to say, well, I just don't feel ready, you know, for marriage, but I'm ready to use this person sexually. You know, the underlying thought is, I just don't know if she's really good enough. I mean, she's all right for now, but someone better may come along. How would I know? I just don't know if I want to make that commitment. But in the meantime, I don't see why we can't use each other for sex. Using another's body while retaining the right to dump that person and go elsewhere, that's what sexual immorality is all about. Breaking the promise that you made to your spouse. A lie, an act of treachery. That's what sexual immorality is about. And we do this not for the benefit of the other at all. But that is being done for me. And so this pattern begins to set up in our minds where sex is a hunting ground for me to get something that I really like. For me. And maybe it'll hurt another person. Maybe it will strand another person. Well, you know, if you can't stand the heat, don't get into the kitchen. You know, it's not my problem. And so there's an inherent selfishness that's building into our concepts of sexuality. A woman who marries a man today, who's had 25 partners in bed, is being held up to a standard that is totally unrealistic. 20 different women, different parts and aspects of which that guy probably really likes, and more than he does you, frankly. And so we find that it's almost as if all 20 of them are in bed with you. We are thinking about sexuality in a self-serving way rather than in a self-giving way. It's the giving of myself to another person that I don't want, I'm not willing to do, and that's why I'm not willing to get married right now. Why not just be honest enough to admit that? The problem is, these patterns ingrain themselves into our mind in a very deep way, and then it's just not that easy to suddenly turn it around and people think, well, I know I'm sowing my wild oats right now because I'm pretty young, but you know, someday I'll probably get married and do the family thing. Oh yeah, oh, you think that, do you? Well, it ain't that easy to suddenly reverse patterns of thinking, deep branded images in your mind, and to dismiss all that and suddenly have a blank slate to start a new life with your spouse, that's not the way it works. We're sensitive, spiritual beings. And when we wound the fabric of our soul, those wounds leave scars. Distrust, shame. You know, when two people are really using each other, even if it's what she wants, we both know what we're doing. And it becomes pretty hard to trust, frankly, at a deep level, when you know perfectly well that the reason we're not getting married here is because, you know, we're just here to have some fun and book out later. How can you trust someone like that? We're not willing to give ourselves to each other. We're not willing to share our lives. It's nothing as deep as that. And there's no basis for trust. And that becomes a pattern, being distrustful. You know, I run around. You know probably then that your wife or your husband probably would run around too. People who live lives in pornia, come into marriage, suffer extra pangs, extreme pangs of jealousy and worry that their spouse will run around on. I think there's inwardly also a shame that we feel. Of course, we can banter on about how there's nothing wrong with this, nothing wrong with this, nothing wrong with this. But in those certain moments in our hearts, we know what we're doing is not right. Guilt can easily become associated with sexuality. People think that, you know, circulating a lot at the club and the parties, having lots of sex and stuff is real social. And yet, talk to the people you know. Maybe you're one yourself who's lived this lifestyle. Is it really? Isn't it really what leads to loneliness? You know, it's not the joining of lives. This concept of a union relationship that Jesus talked about, where the two become one, that's what we really crave in our soul. God's made us to desire that. The desire to actually fuse my life to another's, to have someone in my life with me. That's what God made us to desire. And nothing less than that will ever satisfy. So there's this gnawing emptiness there. Instead of finding ourselves sexually satisfied under the porneia model, we actually find our desire for sex increasing. You know, as if you were eating a diet made of foods that, you know, look like normal foods, but they're all fabricated from powdered wood. It's like, you know, it wouldn't make you sick to eat sawdust, but it's not going to give you any nutrition either. And the more of that food you eat, the hungrier you're going to get. And your body's going to be crying out, this is not good enough. Give me more, more, more. That didn't work. I need another. And that's exactly what we face when we're substituting the raw stimulation of porneia for real sexual love that God designed us for. We're actually starving our souls, and it makes us more and more hungry all the time. There's this deepening sexual thirst. The old things don't even satisfy. We need something more extravagant, someone more far out. A lot of us become alienated from sex altogether. You know, after you've been battered like this, used by different people, some of us eventually recoil and actually lose sexual functionality. The whole area of sex just becomes kind of yucky and gross. And we find ourselves, you know, alienated from our own sexuality. That can happen too. This is our claim, that the big sexual obsession of our age, where we can't even turn on our TVs, our computers, listen to a song, you know, look at a magazine or anything else without this blaring sex message just flashing in our face constantly, is not a sign that sex is now reaching a point of liberation and deepening appreciation and we're just getting sexier all the time. But in fact, is a sign of the complete poverty and the lack of love and ultimately the weakening of sex. That's what we're seeing. And the whole obsession thing with sex is just a sign of hunger, is all it is. So there's more and more sexual activity, less and less satisfaction. No, this is not how God made us to be. It's a big problem. I think we could basically claim that in sexual immorality, the partner that we're having sex with has been reduced to the level of a subhuman symbol. It's kind of the pornographic ideal. A shape. A person becomes just a shape that gratifies me without any comment or complaint and goes away. And the pornographic idea rules. Boy, I minister on campus, you know, and it's just considered so bizarre. People, I've had several people just in the past few months talking about how they were at a party or gathering with some friends at school and stuff, and people were just like, what is it with you? Why don't you have sex? And they're just baffled that someone would not be sleeping around. I think that's so weird. Like, it's pathological. If you've got kids, if you've got teenagers today, you got a lot to worry about. They're going to be facing social pressure on this. It's, you know, we thought people were pretty randy when I was in school. Nothing like this. Nothing like this. I mean, it is, you are just a freak if you're not getting hit in the sheets in school today. Yeah. I don't think this animalistic view of sex is anything lofty, noble, or wonderful at all. In fact, it's just lowering sex to the commonplace and to the worthless. You know, you could scoop up a handful of gravel and come up to your buddy and say, what will you give me for this? He'll be like, nothing. If I want some gravel, I'll pick up my own handful, right? I mean, it's not really worth anything. If those were cut diamonds, though, it'd be a different answer, right? Cut diamonds are worth a lot. But there aren't that many cut diamonds around. It's kind of rare. When something gets too commonplace, when it just gets bastardized and prostituted all over the place, it loses value. It's really not that significant anymore. And this view of humans as being just like the rest of the animal order is really picturing sex as a pointless act between pointless creatures. The whole concept that this could somehow be significant in some ultimate sense is just lost here. And so I think we really have something to talk about in this whole field, because that's not our view. You saw what Paul said. He said, even when you hit the sheets with a prostitute and tell yourself, well, this is just a night of pleasure here, this is nothing. Oh, it may be a lot more than you think. You're actually joining yourself in some mystical way to that person, and you know, you didn't intend that, but it's going to happen anyway. Sex goes very deep. We think that it's a profound event that goes right down to the soul of a human being. It's nothing minor. You know, if you had to blow your nose, I, for one, would not care when you did it, how you did it, or anything else. It's not very significant. Do what you want. That's a mere biological, you know, function, blowing your nose. Sex is nothing like that. Oh yeah, sex is very deep, very profound. And it's because it is so important that moral rules also apply here. This is not an area that can be moved outside of the area of moral discussion. Not at all. The pornea perspective says, well, you know, it's a mistake to make too big a deal out of making love. If you feel good about it and you want it, then why not? And we answer to that, you know, that humans sense within themselves this need for a lasting committed relationship, that we've been made that way. The problem is we're just unwilling or unable to deliver what it takes to make such a relationship work. And that is increasingly the story of our culture. Unable to pull off a successful, lifelong, deep relationship with another human being. It really gets to where we just are unable to give ourselves to another. We've been so long holding back, keeping mine for me, that the whole act of giving myself over completely to another is just too scary, and it's too difficult. We can't do it. What are the keys to a successful sexual relationship in our culture, in the culture of pornea? Well, sexual compatibility, you hear a lot about that. Be sure you're sexually compatible. Good hot bodies, you know, we got to get to the gym, got to get the buns of steel, that's going to help there. You know, and we showing up looking the wrong way. And of course, a test-driven relationship. You know, you'd certainly be crazy to try to go into any long-term thing without, you wouldn't buy a car without test driving it, would you? We did a series of interviews on campus on the street down there, and not even one person in 20 thought that it made any sense to jump into a marriage when you haven't even slept with each other, you know, many times, really, because you can't go by the first time at all. That's the consensus that we live in, yeah. You'd be insane. What if you got married and there was a problem and you didn't know that? For us, we'd be like, well, then you work that out in your committed relationship. That's why you need to be committed, so you can work on things like that. But to the self-first thesis, to someone living for me, you know, that would mean that I would be confronted with a problem, and that would not be optimal for me at all. And what a mistake, man. If I get into something, it's going to be because it's awesome and because I get a lot out of it. They're not there to give. Let's think about these propositions. What does the research say? Here's a survey, a comprehensive review of recent research. These are authorities from Rutgers University, Pocono, and Whitehead who These are not Christians, okay? These are just sociologists, psychologists studying all the research that's been done over the past 10 years in this field. And here's what they say about the idea of test driving your mate. They say, virtually all research on the topic has determined that the chances of divorce ending a marriage preceded by cohabitation, living together, are significantly greater than for a marriage not preceded by cohabitation. Oh, well, now, wait a minute. That's just the opposite of what everyone believes, isn't it? I thought the argument was you definitely have to test it out and see if you're going to be sexually compatible. You'd be crazy to go into a marriage without that. But what does the research say? The opposite of that. And when they say that your marriage is significantly more likely to end in divorce if you live together beforehand, they're not kidding. It's almost twice as likely. And these are not Christian marriages we're talking about. This is just marriages in our culture. Twice as likely to be divorced if you live together beforehand. The longer you live together, the more likely divorce is. Oh, well, that just doesn't fit the model at all now, does it? That fits God's model perfectly. It's exactly what we would predict based on biblical thinking. You're violating God's pattern for your life, and there's going to be a price to pay for that. They go on saying, living together before marriage increases the risk of breaking up after marriage. Unmarried couples have lower levels of happiness and well-being than married couples. Oh, well, that's an interesting one there. And this is not like the researchers are saying, we think they're unhappy. This is the people themselves saying, I'm unhappy. These are all based on surveys where they rate their own level of happiness, and they're saying, I rate my, my happiness is rated at a 3. The married people over here are saying, we're 8.5. The disparity is quite remarkable. So we think to ourselves, if I'm going down to the club and hooking up with some hot person, every other night, that is exciting. Someday I might get married, when I'm tired of having fun. Then I might have to do that. I don't know, if you're old or whatever. I guess it comes to that someday. But what are the facts? The facts are that it's the people engaging in sexual immorality that report, we're not very happy here. The ones who are saying we are happy are the married people. Yeah, exactly the opposite of that again. They say, in summary, no positive contribution of cohabitation to marriage has ever been found. And this is coming from non-Christian, secular, PhD authorities in the field. This is what the literature says. I could read these all night long, one study after another. They all show the same thing. They point out that while marriages are held together by a strong ethic of commitment, cohabiting relationships, by their very nature, tend to undercut this ethic. Oh, they're saying the same thing I'm saying, aren't they? Yeah. That whole pattern of life where I want to get to grips with you but don't ask for commitment, that is just cutting a groove deeper and deeper into your mind. And then when you do get married, it's still there. Nothing's changed. Going through a ceremony doesn't change anything. Yeah, there is no such thing as sexual compatibility. And certainly hitting the sheets with someone that you're not married to would never tell you anything about it. That would be the last thing that would ever tell you anything about it. This whole perspective is shot. I hope none of us have any place in our mind for this kind of thinking. We should be strong on this. I work a lot of times with student Christians on campus, and I sense them sort of blanching and tiptoeing around the subject when it comes up and so forth. Hey, we don't need to be ashamed of what we believe when it comes to sexual ethics. We're in the right here, and everything backs it up. Everything right down the line. Boy, is it a shock for people in the world to come into the body of Christ and then to see marriages there that actually work. Not just a few, most of them. And not often not without a struggle. It's not that easy, frankly. There's a lot about marriage that kind of actually runs directly against our flesh natures, our selfish, inborn natures. So there's a struggle there, yeah. And that's why you need that framework of unquestioned commitment, that no matter how difficult this is, one thing will never happen is, and I'm never walking out of this, we will solve this problem right here. That's how marriage works. Well, in our view, of course, the keys to a successful sexual relationship have nothing to do with the buns of steel. I have nothing against buns of steel. I wish I had some. But that is going to make very little difference, frankly, in the success of a real lifelong sexual relationship. Our key, we believe, and we're taught this in the Word of God, is that if you want a successful sexual relationship, the first thing you need to do is center that relationship on God. Yeah, let's go to some of my old illustrations I like on this. This is my Abercrombie guys here. Clip art. See, if your relationship is not centered in God, then what is it centered on? It's basically just centered on each other. And so the other becomes that which you're defining yourself by. You are dependent on that other one for your identity and for your unmet emotional needs. So there are needs and expectations there that each have for the other. Now, it's possible on a temporary basis to come together, and there might be such a synergy there that, you know, I'm feeling that you're meeting my needs and she's feeling that I'm meeting her needs and that everything's in balance there, and it just seems like it's working out pretty good. But how long is that going to last? Not very long. Pretty soon, one of us starts to think, you know, I kind of get the feeling I'm meeting more needs than I'm getting met of mine here. I'm not sure you're doing your part. And a tussle begins. The fact is, there's no secure base from which to give. It's all a business deal. And so, you know, it's as long as I feel that I'm getting back as much as I'm giving, I might be okay with it because it's a profitable business deal. Well, that's not the way it works. We end up in a marriage where the basic theme is trying to get what I want. And that's what the self-based marriage is like. Two people trying to get what I want. Who gets what? Power relations in the relationship tend to dictate how that works out. And so in postmodern literature on marriage, it's all rife with talk about the power relations. And the key is, you know, not to have the male being all powerful and in various ways you have to make sure that you're not getting your arm twisted and manipulated and that you have enough power to stand your own ground and get yours. Well, that's some of the fallen counsel that you can get on marriage in our day. Our model's like this. Both of us submitting our lives to the leadership of God, and He is at the center of this relationship. We define ourselves not by the other person, but we define ourselves by who God thinks I am. We draw our identity from God and who I am as a child of His. I don't need the other person to define who I am. I'm not dependent on them for that. My relational need for a unity relationship, to be one with another, is met in the first place when I'm joined to God. You hear what Paul said? The one who joins himself to a prostitute becomes one with her, but the one who joins himself to God is one spirit with Him. This longing we have to be at one with another is met when we initiate that relationship with God and invite His Spirit is literally joined to ours, according to Paul. And so that at a very deep level, our relational needs are met in our relationship with God. And the result is that instead of depending on this other person to meet my needs, I come in with my needs basically met, and I can give out of abundance. I'm not worried about whether I'm getting it back or not. I get what I need for my relationship with God. Well, this is pretty mature stuff, frankly, pretty advanced, but that's our model right there. It's really a three-way relationship, and there's also the concept then that as the two of us grow closer to God, we're also growing closer to each other. A God-centered relationship. You get into a relationship like that where each person under God is intent on how I can give, how I can build up that spouse of mine, how I can understand her needs and meet them. That is going to be hot sex. Okay? There's how you succeed in a sex relationship. It has to be based, in the first place, on a personal relationship founded on the principles taught to us in the Word of God. It's no longer what he wants. It's no longer what she wants. Our question is, what does God want? The power relations are irrelevant here. There are no power relations. We're both submitted to a moral authority above us, which is God. Also, in addition to centering a relationship in God, we argue that sex should be reserved entirely for that committed relationship, a commitment that is a life commitment. In marriage, nothing less will do. We say, oh yeah, but we really love each other, and we basically feel that we're married. It's the same thing. I mean, we don't have a piece of paper or whatever, but, you know, what does that matter? That's just a human thing. That's nothing. So if it's such a small thing, why don't you just do it then? There's a lot of dishonesty in this. There's a lot of dishonesty in this, yeah. You know why you won't do it. It's not small at all. You're avoiding that. No, you're not committed at all. If you're not willing to sign and put your life on the line, how's that commitment? Just think of a continuum here between at one end, life commitment, and at the other end, you're on probation. You're in a position where, based on any one of maybe 1,000 different criteria, you could be dumped tomorrow. You don't even know what the criteria are half the time. You're being assessed for whether you're good enough. Which of these two environments is going to give you the security that you need to be able to be vulnerable enough to develop a happy sexual life together? And this should be obvious. On the probation end, we're dealing with pure self-gratification. At the life commitment end, we're dealing with self-giving love, self-sacrificial love. And so, you know, it's hard to be vulnerable. It's hard to open up. But I think how hard it is to open up when you know perfectly well that the person you're dealing with is there working on a pure self-gratification principle. They're there to take. So I'll give you a saying that they gave me as a student, and I remembered it always. Love, according to the Bible, can always wait to give, but lust can never wait to take. Oh, baby, I just love you so much. Oh, man, we have to go for it. Come on. That's not love at all. How is that in the interest of that other person? To call on them to engage in porneia and sexual immorality. There's no love there. This is all about being a love taker instead of a love giver. And all of this whole discussion is really just about that. Are you going to be a taker? Are you going to be a giver? Yeah, reserve for commitment. Definitely believe in that. And also then, that the relationship has to be other-centered, that it can't be this me-taking. And that takes sometimes years to really learn the depth of what that means. Boy, this is not easy at all. This is pretty profound. A lot of people are able to operate pretty well, and they feel like they're pretty sacrificial and good at relationships, you know, before they're married. But then marriage all of a sudden seems to move you into the sphere of intimacy that goes well beyond the relational capability you've developed so far. And all of a sudden, it turns out you're pretty selfish after all. And God uses this in the lives of believers to throw back the blanket and say, so you're nowhere near where you need to be, are you? And that was the effect that I had when I got married. I thought I was all right. I had good friends, you know. I got married, but I wasn't ready for that. Whew. Whoa. I wasn't ready for that. Thank God that we got married, and my wife and I, under a commitment that was rock hard. And it was tested for years. We suffered through. And it was all, I would sit there and I would realize, this is me. Sometimes I'd blame her. But in my more honest moments, I knew this would happen no matter who I married. Same thing would happen. It's me. What is wrong with me? Why am I so selfish? Why can't I get over this? And man, that struggle in front of God lasted for me for several years. It doesn't have to be that bad. Okay, man, I had some special problems here. I was pretty resistant. And I was too proud to get any help. I was so embarrassed about how much trouble we were having, I wouldn't go get any help. So that set us back. It didn't have to be that bad. But I'm glad that we stuck through it. And I've been married, I'll be 34th anniversary this summer. And I believe that me and my wife both think that our marriage is the most awesome thing that's ever happened in our lives. This is what God has used more than anything else to deconstruct our characters and rebuild it in similarity to Christ. You know, it's interesting that the prevalence of marriage is really declining in our culture. This article, just this past year, an AFP article about, while it's by no means dead, marriage, for the first time, a new survey has shown that traditional marriage has ceased to be the preferred living arrangement in the majority of U.S. households. This is reported by the U.S. Census Bureau, and its 2005 American Community Survey indicated that marriage did not figure in nearly 55.8 million American households, which is the majority. More than 14 million of these households were headed by single women, another 5 million by single men, while 36.7 million of the households referred primarily to gay or heterosexual couples cohabiting out of formal wedlock. In addition, there were more than 30 million unmarried men and women living alone who are not categorized as families. So this is just the families they're studying. If you lump those extra 30 million single households in there, it would be even way more lopsided. Douglas Besharov, a sociologist with the American Enterprise Institute, Washington-based think tank, said, it's difficult for the traditional family to emerge unscathed after 3.5 decades of divorce rates reaching 50% and 5 decades of out-of-wedlock births. He predicted that cohabitation and temporary relationships between people were likely to dominate America's social landscape for years to come. I don't think anyone can doubt that. Here's a study reported by Reuters. Americans are more socially isolated than they were 20 years ago. Nearly a quarter of people surveyed said they had zero close friends with whom to discuss personal matters. This is last year, this article, this study came out. This is a big social change, and it indicates something that's not good for our society, said Duke University professor Lynn Smith-Lovin. I can't believe that's her name. Head author of the study to be published in the American Sociological Review. She said it indicated that people had a surprising drop in the number of close friends since 1985. Smith-Lovin said that part of the cause could be that Americans are working more, marrying later, having fewer children, and commuting longer distances. So the materialism probably does have a lot to do with it. We all think that we can make ourselves happy by getting more money, so we're working on that. Marrying later, there's more and more skepticism about marriage. Have you heard that divorce rates have decreased in the last few years after rising to this crescendo in the late 80s, early 90s? That's a very misleading statistic. Divorce rates are usually measured by number of divorces per 1,000 women or per 1,000 men. But the fact is that marriage has also declined, and so the relationship between divorce and marriage is as bad as it's ever been. There has been no decrease. Jesus said an interesting thing in Matthew 24, verse 12. that in the last days, as lawlessness is increased, most people's love will grow cold. Oh, what a chilling prediction by the Son of God. He says things are going to head down a pathway where eventually all categories of right and wrong are going to be erased, and the effect is going to be real chilling on people's ability to love. And I think that's happening in our culture. It's not just that marriage doesn't work in our culture, but increasingly people are just unable to form deep relationships of any kind. I want to read one last passage to you from 1 Thessalonians 4. This is Paul speaking again. He says, "This is the will of God, your sanctification. That is, that you abstain from sexual immorality. That each of you know how to possess his own vessel, body, your body, in sanctification and honor. Not in lustful passion like the Gentiles who don't know God." And he says, anyone who refuses to live by these rules is not disobeying human rules, but is rejecting God, who gives his Holy Spirit to you. What an awesome claim that he's making here. He's saying this whole issue of sexual morality is not a cultural construct at all. You know, you hear that. People are like, well, you know, culture's changing and stuff. You know, the Bible's pretty old. I mean, this is a modern world we're in here. So, you know, things are changing. Yeah, well, guess what? God hasn't changed at all. He's the same as he ever was. And our nature hasn't really changed either. So really, none of the elements that go into what makes right and wrong in this area have changed at all. How do you do it? Now you want to know how to do it, huh? Well, let me just give you a couple of hints, a little forecast. We'll be discussing this next week. The first thing is you've got to get in touch with the love of God. If you want a God-centered relationship, you've got to get God in your life. 1 John 4:19 says, "We love because he first loved us." We're frankly incapable of giving love at the sacrificial level. We have no basis, no reason, and no ability to do that until God fills our heart with his love. The first thing you have to do is let the love of God come into your life. And I'll tell you, you know, coming to God has a lot of benefits, like, you know, eternal life. That counts for something. There's a lot of things that, but one of the great benefits of coming to Jesus Christ and giving your life to him is he can show you how to finally succeed in your sexual life. He can bring you a successful sexual relationship because he's the one who knows how this works. Inviting Christ into your life, we call it receiving Christ. It says in John 1 that to as many as received him, he gave the right to become the children of God. I know you may have been to church before, but it's necessary to receive Christ personally. Have you ever actually turned to Christ and invited him to come into your life? And there's the beginning point for having a God-centered relationship. The second concept would be that if we're not married, we prepare for married life by learning the relational skills that God teaches us. And we learn these in the body of Christ because the relational skills that I need to use in learning to build rich relationships like with my roommates or my friends are identical to the ones that I would use in a marriage. And so our immaturities need to be smoked out in our inability to be sacrificially loving, are smoked out, hopefully, before we ever get to the altar. That's the best thing. And if we've already been to the altar, then we're going to have to try to learn those things within marriage. And that's also possible. You know, there's a little bit more tension involved because we've actually gotten way ahead of ourselves here. So we're going to be scrambling. It's a little tense, but never too late. And God can teach us the things we need to know. Well, we'll save that for next week when we talk about what goes into a good marriage, a good sexual relationship, and how can we develop those qualities in ourselves. Okay, I'm going to take a few questions from the floor tonight. All right, who's got a thought or question, comment to add? How about back here?
Hey, Dennis, thanks for addressing this. As new parents, before we had a baby, I mean, as we were pregnant, we prayed for him, and one of the areas was that he would take a stand in this area as he grows up. And probably about when he was 2 months old, my husband was changing his diaper, and he was talking to him, and he was talking to him about self-control with his, you know, his ding-ding. And I was laughing, but then as we were talking, I'm like, we have to start talking to him at a young age about being self-control and all that. So as a parent of boys, of kid, you know, you have three kids, how do young parents, you know, start addressing these issues or talking, dialoguing with their kids?
Well, I don't know about 2 years old, but...
No, he was 2 months.
Usually we get... Oh, 2 months. Well, I guess you can practice at that age, but... pretty bluntly and pretty directly, in my opinion. I think we are, as parents, are in a position to get our message in there first. And we need to do that and make it clear that they'll know what sex is at a pretty early age, and we should go with that and talk openly about it, and that there's God's way and there's the other way, and that the stakes are pretty high, that you can do a lot of damage to yourself if you go the other way, and that their friends at school are going to be doing that, and they're going to be confronted with opportunities, and they're going to maybe even be called names if they don't join in, and they need to decide what they're going to do about that. And I argued the case vigorously to each of my kids, and all of them have gone, you know, to marriage, or I still have one unmarried, but they're all, you know, ended up as going as virgins, and I think that's to their advantage. No question that sexual temptation is the biggest danger to Christian kids in our culture today. In our campus ministry, we lose more students to sexual immorality than all other causes put together by a pretty wide margin. That is the issue that is breaking the walks of Christian young people today, because it's so rampant, so radically available, and they're viewed often as such freaks if they aren't just sleeping around all the time. It takes a strong spirituality, frankly, to resist that current. Thank God we've got a very powerful body of serious Christian students here. You know, we're talking about over 1,000 students who are really serious about following Christ. And so there's a community there that they can be a part of, you know, at Ohio State and Columbus State, where there's a consensus and people agree on what's right here. So I would try to get also my kids hooked up with a strong Christian ministry like what we have here, and, you know, work hand in glove with them, because that can be a social grouping that doesn't share the same consensus. A child who is isolated, including a college student, who is isolated on a campus somewhere where everyone around them, and they're really the only person there who doesn't share the pornea consensus, is really on thin ice. It's very difficult. It would take an extraordinary person to withstand that. So there's a few thoughts for you. Okay, how about here?
Well, this is a really sobering teaching, and I guess I'm wondering if you could speak to the people who might be sitting here thinking, man, I've totally messed up. That groove that's dug is so deep. You know, is there any hope for me to have a satisfying long-term committed relationship if I've lived a life of promiscuity or stuff like that?
Yeah. Well, a lot of us are in that position, actually. And I'm glad you brought that up, because I meant to say that that's one of the things we want to talk about next week. You know, God will actually work with our minds and our spirits to bring us to a point of spiritual virginity, even though the other is no longer possible. We can get to the point where much of this damage, probably not all of it, but where much of it has basically been healed by God. And that's one of the steps we need to think about in progressing towards successful marriages, is that a lot of the crap that we've piled up needs to be dealt with. So I'd say come back next week. Okay? Yeah.
I can tell you that, you know, being a virgin at a young age was a bad thing where I was growing up, and, you know, the tide was going the other way, like you said, but jumping in with the tide and going against God's moral layout of sex. Well, I tell you what, I could, if she had a couple of weeks to listen, I could tell you that the damage and the misery and the heartache that you cause a lot of people around you. And it's funny because the world says, you know, you're the man and that's, you know, that's good, that's what you should be doing. And they stroke you for it. But in the quiet of your own mind, when the party's over and you're home, everyone's gone, it's, you're burned so deep inside that you know it's wrong. But yet, it, you know, it's the way that things are going, and it's the way of the world. But I tell you, if I could convince anybody, if there's any way I could convince anybody to not go down that path and to tell them the price that I've paid for that, what the world said was cool, I'd be very willing to talk to them.
Yeah. Well, I've heard so many people say what you're saying. And, you know, here's an interesting point, too. I counsel a lot of people I talk to. That's been my work for 30-some years, is, you know, talking to people a lot about their lives and stuff. And I have yet to meet the first person who has ever said, I regret waiting till I was married. Wish I hadn't done that. That just is not found. You find tons of people with bitter regret that I didn't wait. Well, I think one of the things we really have to do is get a hold of the grace of God on this. God is all forgiving. He's a God of healing. And a lot of us have messed up pretty bad. But, you know, that's the business that Jesus is in, is healing lives and transforming us. He changes lives. And it's probably going to be a long-term project. You know, some of the problems we get in that mental and spiritual area can be pretty profound, and they don't come out of there real easy. So, but there's things we can do, but you're quite right. You just wish sometimes, especially working with young people, that you could persuade them that, man, don't go this way. And some of us have to learn the hard way.
The idea of the substantial healing on the other side, I mean, I don't want to leave on such a somber note because, you know, walking with the Lord for 20 years and having a wife that walks with the Lord for 20 years and having the Word and having a backlog of God changing you, and you see people that you know change and you see yourself change and you see these people in these marriages that are absolutely the worst disasters you could ever imagine, and you just try to hang in there with them and you pray with them and you watch them change like some people that I'm sitting in this building with today, and you think, if God can do that, He can do it with me, and as He's done it with me, it's sort of like, you know, you learn it from somebody, then you pass it to the next guy and the next guy. I mean, that's where
we're going to hear a story next week. In fact, a married couple here are going to share how God took their demolished, awful marriage and repaired it and put them on a footing today of real love, and it's just awesome. We see it all the time. It's really the power of God. That's one of the, that alone would be a reason to come to Christ, right there. Get your marriage healed. I'm out of time, so sorry for being long-winded, but we're going to have to cut off the questions here and save a few minutes to pray together. Lord, You truly are, You're the God of love. You're the one who's made us. You're the one who knows how this works. And we acknowledge that tonight, God. Boy, do we have a lot to learn when it comes to how to really give ourselves in love. And nothing shows us that more clearly than marriage. We got a long way to go, Lord. But we just want to thank and praise You for Your life-changing power and the way You have shaped and molded so many of us. God, we're doing things and we're functioning at a level we never would have believed we could before. And we attribute all of that to You and Your power. None of this that we're talking about tonight would make any sense if we didn't have Your Spirit within us, if we didn't know You in a personal way. It doesn't work. And so I pray, God, that those of us sitting here who aren't certain whether we've ever actually received You into our lives, whether we've ever opened ourselves to Your love in a direct way, that we would make sure of that tonight. and just speak to you and say, God, I do need you, and please help me in my life, because I have problems here too. And we thank you for that, God, in Jesus' name. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.